Good evening. I am here to give you a double welcome to this evening's event. The first welcome comes from our president, Bill Durden, who is unfortunately traveling this evening. He's out on the other side of the country, among other things, raising money for the college, which we believe to be a good activity. But it meant that he couldn't be here tonight, and it disappoints him greatly because he is, as those of you who know him appreciate, very much into the history of the college and events that celebrate that history. And so he welcomes you in absentia. And the other is my own personal welcome. I'm Neil Weissman. I'm the provost and dean of the college, and delighted to have you here this evening. My job tonight is to give a little bit of an introductory commentary, relatively brief, don't worry, about the nature of the Priestley Award. And the award this has been something we've been doing since 1952, and the list of awardees is very, very distinguished indeed, and I encourage you to get the entire list and take a look. It's on the webpage, among other places. But the award is really, if you think about it historically, the Priestley Award is the result of the interaction of three people. One of them, of course, is the college's founder, Benjamin Rush. Rush was an interesting character, political activist, as I trust most of you know. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and one of the major figures in the independence movement. He was an abolitionist, quite rare among non-Quakers in the North at that time. He believed in educating women, which was, at the time, a politically radical view, and was very active across the board in colonial politics and American Revolutionary politics. He also, as, again, many of you from the college will know, he also, though, was colonial America's foremost physician, leading doctor, and as a consequence had a deep interest in science. He is considered to be the first chemistry professor in America because he taught chemistry. He is considered to be the father of American psychiatry because of his studies on the subject of people who were mentally challenged at the time. And he, when he founded Dickinson College, as a result, science, and chemistry in particular, but science in general, was an important part of the deal. So Rush is the first of the three people. The second, of course, is Joseph Priestley himself. Priestley, clearly his standing as a scientist is very well known, even you could say iconic. And, of course, every time you think of Priestley, you immediately think of the discovery of oxygen, or as a new recent biography of him puts it, the invention of air, meaning discovery of the concept. But if you read that biography, as I just did this last summer, you find out that he had an extraordinarily lively mind, and work on oxygen was only one small piece of what he did. To give you one tiny example that really caught my attention, he argued that his happiest discovery, the one that gave him the most pleasure, was in fact, it was an invention, and it was the invention of carbonated beverages. I don't know if you knew that Priestley invented them, and he had the idea that soda water, carbonated beverages, could defeat scurvy as a medical matter, that the British Navy ought to use it. And in fact, when Captain Cook sailed off on his expeditions, all of the ships in his little fleet had soda water machines because of Joseph Priestley. Now, this was not the most important scientific discovery that Priestley ever made, but it did lead him on to work on the subject of air and toward the discovery of oxygen. So, an example of a lively mind and one that does things big and small. But Priestley also, and it's important, I think, to understand and emphasize, was a radical too, like Benjamin Rush. In fact, his nickname was Gunpowder Joe. And I used to think, honestly, that it had to do with some experiments that he'd run with gunpowder, and that's not at all the case. It had to do with a political speech that he once gave in which he used the image of laying gunpowder, as he put it, grain by grain, to explode error and superstition, by which he meant the practice and beliefs of the Church of England. So he was a political and religious radical, so much so that, in fact, he infuriated public opinion. And as some of you, I'm sure, know, a mob actually burned down his home, probably would have done him in had he not fled. And, in fact, he wound up fleeing to the United States. His most recent biographer, in fact, refers to him as the Salman Rushdie of Georgian England, in that he had to flee in order to protect his life. And, of course, he wound up just north of here, up the Susquehanna River, where he set up shop and became a very close friend of Benjamin Rush. The third person that key to the creation of the connections that led to this award is Thomas Cooper. Thomas Cooper was a distinguished scientist also in colonial America, and he was a friend of both Rush and Priestley. In 1811, he was hired as the first science professor at Dickinson College. In fact, we were able to hire him away from the University of Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson was trying to recruit him. So he's a very distinguished fellow, also a political radical, had very, very extreme views for his time. And in fact, in addition to being a scientist, he was one of only 10 men in early America who were actually prosecuted and convicted under the Alien and Sedition Acts. I didn't know that until recently. So he was convicted for sedition as a result of his radical views and only lasted at Dickinson for 3 years as a result. But during that time, he was the one who arranged for Joseph Priestley's equipment to be moved from Priestley's home after Priestley deceased here to the college. And, of course, it is in our library now. The equipment is there. If you think about these three men, though, Rush, Priestley, and Cooper, two things emerge, and I hope are clear from what I've said. One of them is their achievement as scientists. All of them were very accomplished in that arena. And the other is their engagement as citizens. In this particular case, in these three cases, it was a kind of radical politics. But the general point is these were people who saw science as being embedded in their relationship to society generally. And that is reflected in the concept that we celebrate here tonight of the Priestley Award. The Dickinson College Award, in memory of Joseph Priestley, honors a distinguished scientist for work that contributes to the betterment of humankind. That's the idea, and it reflects these three founders. Certainly, our awardee this evening fulfills that calling. To explain precisely how, I will ask Professor Marie Helvig Larsen to come forward and give you an introduction. Thank you.
Good evening. Psychologists are frequently implored to give away psychology by using our scientific research and knowledge to inform law, policy, health, education. Giving away science takes a lot of courage, though, particularly when what your research shows flies in the face of dearly held but incorrect beliefs. One particularly notable aspect of Dr. Loftus' work is the courage she has shown in weathering scorn and oppression that unfortunately often accompanies clear and compelling scientific data that is contrary to popular beliefs. Dr. Loftus has consistently defended open scientific inquiry and debate, even when her research and her person has been attacked. Not many of us have had to experience, as Dr. Loftus has, the necessity of having a personal bodyguard so as to be able to serve or give an academic talk. Not today, but in the past. A second factor that makes Dr. Loftus a particularly worthy recipient of the Priestley Award is the scientific rigor that she has used in investigating the difficult and controversial questions of how memory works. In some of her most recent work, she's applying her research on memory to health issues, as in contrast to her earlier work on the law, by examining how you can implant false memories about liking healthy foods or disliking unhealthy foods. In fact, my favorite title from a 2008 article is Asparagus, a Love Story, : Healthier Eating Could Be Just a False Memory Away. The Priestley Award is given to a distinguished scientist whose work has contributed to the welfare of humanity. Dr. Loftus is just such a scientist. Please welcome me, help me in welcoming Dr. Loftus.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me all right with the microphone now? Okay. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor for me to even be connected with Joseph Priestley. I will tell you that some of my friends back at my university in the chemistry department are showing some new respect for psychology at this point. And wandering through the library and seeing his artifacts and equipment and reading a little bit about how when they bombed his house and bombed his lab and sent a flyer around calling him a damned rascal, I thought, well, that hasn't happened to me, at least not yet, but it is an honor to be connected to him and for me to have a chance to talk with you briefly about the work that I and my collaborators have done in the area of memory and memory distortion, some of which has gotten me into trouble, but is rewarding anyhow. I like to start with an actual memory situation. As a scientist who studies memory, I see memory problems everywhere, and I love it when good ones fall in my lap, as happened last year when Hillary Clinton was running for the Democratic presidential nomination. And on the campaign trail, on several occasions, she talked about this trip she had taken to Bosnia, a memorable occasion in her life because it was somewhat traumatic. And in her own words, she said, "I remember landing under sniper fire. There was supposed to be some kind of greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles to get to our base." Well, what Hillary may have not thought about or may have forgotten or possibly not realized is there were other people present on that trip, and some of them were taking photographs and videos. And so the actual landing in Bosnia, which occurred in 1996, looked very different than the way she was describing it on the campaign trail. It was a peaceful landing. There she is with her daughter Chelsea, their children greeting her. And so what is going on there with her talking about the sniper fire and the canceled airport reception and so on? What is going on? Well, pundits had a field day with this, and one of them gave her four Pinocchios, insinuating, or, you know, strongly insinuating that she was deliberately lying. Four Pinocchios because there was no corkscrew landing, there was no sniper fire, there was no canceled airport reception, and she was not the first lady to go into a war zone. Was she deliberately lying? This seems rather unlikely, and so what does she have to say about this situation? She had an explanation, which she had to have, and her explanation was this: I made a mistake, I had a different memory. That happens, that proves I'm human, which for some people is a revelation. Now, I like this example because I think it shows you that all that education, all that intelligence, all that experience doesn't protect you from having false memories. And I want to tell you a little bit about what I've learned about false memories through some of my earlier work and now and some recent work I'll tell you about. So I do tend to focus my interest on legal cases because their very precise memory often matters a lot. I've paid a lot of attention to cases of wrongful conviction. You just need to go to the Innocence Project website. You can find hundreds of cases of wrongful conviction, people who were convicted of crimes they didn't do. We now know from DNA analysis, but they've spent 5, 10, 15 or more years in prison. And when those cases are analyzed, the major cause of those wrongful convictions is faulty human memory. I've also been involved for at least 15 years now with a new category of cases, those involving memory, but a different kind of memory issue. These are allegations involving repressed memory claims. And so this family typifies the kind of case that I'm talking about here. The case, in fact, this was a very famous case in the 90s, so it graced the cover of the Los Angeles Times Sunday magazine. The problems for Gary Ramona, who was an executive with the Mondavi Winery in Napa, California, began when his daughter, Holly, went into therapy. She was a sophomore in college. She goes into therapy, and there she learns that something she never knew before, that her father supposedly raped her between the ages of 5 and 16, forced her into lots of rapes, forced her into sex with the family dog Prince, all allegedly buried in her unconscious until the therapeutic interventions made her aware of the existence of these experiences. So Holly sued her father, and in what really made this case famous is the dad turned around in a separate lawsuit. He sued the therapist for planting false memories in the mind of his daughter and was awarded $500,000 by a jury in Napa. So that's why this case became so well known, because of that third-party litigation against the psychotherapist. So all of these unusual, scientifically unsupported claims, like those in the Ramona family, 11 years of brutalization, allegedly buried into the unconscious when there's no credible scientific support that memory ever works like that, and the sometimes less bizarre but still tragic memories that led to the conviction of all those innocent people, where DNA had to finally prove their innocence. This caused me to rewrite the solemn oath that witnesses take. I think this oath that I've written is really a lot more apt, that we should be having witnesses swear to tell the whole truth or whatever it is you think you remember. But despite the fact that I've been promoting this in a few arena, I can't seem to get it to catch on with the legal system. Okay, so how do I, as a psychological scientist, get involved in these kinds of situations? It's because of work, and it's not just me, but many scientists who work in this area, on memory distortion. And for many, many decades, I did a lot of work in which I showed that it was pretty easy to change memory for the details of an event that you'd actually experienced. I talked in a class today at Dickinson about some of the early work that I and others had done, including some work that showed that you can take people, show them a simulated accident where a car goes through an intersection with a stop sign, and just by asking a simple leading question that insinuates it's a yield sign, you can get lots of people to tell you they saw a yield sign at the intersection, not a stop sign. And this is an example of something that is now well known in the literature called the misinformation effect. When witnesses to an event, something they actually did experience, as the crime victims in the DNA cases did definitely witness or experience a real event, but when people are exposed to misinformation about the event afterwards, it can impair their memory. That's what the misinformation effect is, and that's partly why people get wrongly identified and wrongly convicted of crimes that they didn't do. But in my own work, especially after getting involved in cases like the Ramona case, I and others wanted to go a little bit further. What we wanted to do... Oh, actually, before I tell you what we wanted to do, I thought maybe I'd give you a more recent example of misinformation. And what I'd like to do here, it's a little hard for me to see with all these bright lights, but you'll have a better time seeing each other. I thought I'd make you all subjects in an experiment. using some materials that I and my collaborators have been using for the last few years. Maya Cook, a graduate student at UC Irvine who recently got her PhD, and our collaborator Don Hoffman, a cognitive scientist at UC Irvine. So what I want you to do is just, you know, be subjects, but don't think too hard. Just go with the flow. And I'm gonna show you some faces, and then I'll ask you some questions about those faces afterwards. So here's your study phase, the faces you're going to study. Okay, now, I don't have a whole lot of time because I was told I should talk for 35 or 40 minutes. So if I had more time, I could show you more faces as we would in this work. I would let more time pass, but I don't have that luxury. So now I'm just going to give you a little quiz. And what I want you to do is think to yourself. Don't say anything out loud. Don't indicate to anybody else what you're thinking. But I'm going to show you, for this quiz, a pair of faces, and you should just think to yourself, do you recognize from the study phase the one on the left or the one on the right? So think to yourself, left or right? Don't say anything to anyone else. Think to yourself, left or right? Don't say anything to anyone else. Now, if I had more time, which I don't, but that's okay, I would let more time pass. We'd have more filler activities. This would be like the time that passes between when people are involved in various aspects of the legal system and they ultimately testify in court about what they originally saw. So now let's move ahead. And what I want to do is just a little bit different. I want you to raise your hand and tell me your answer, whether you're picking the one on the left or the right. And the reason I'm asking you to raise your hand is so that we can look around and see what everyone else thinks is the right answer. What is the face you saw in the study phase of the original event? So how many people say left? Raise your hand. Okay, I can see, despite the bright lights, lots and lots of faces. How many say right? Raise your hand. Well, we got a face there. What's your field, Penny? Oh, you're okay. But I think you can see we have a few more people, but mostly I think there is a preference here for the one on the left. Left or how many say left? Raise your hand. I don't see any hands. How about right? Raise your hand. Look around. Lots of hands going up. A strong consensus for the one on the right. How's the lawyer doing over here? Yeah. You're abstaining now, I think, aren't you? Okay. One on the left, raise your hand. Okay, quite a few hands. One on the right, raise your hand. A number of hands. Well, how come the first test you had a lot of consensus, except for the lawyer? The second test trial, a lot of consensus. And now on this third pair, you're kind of divided. What's going on here? I'll tell you what's going on. I showed you three faces. Those were the study faces. I then gave you some test trials at the end, some final test trials. The correct answer for the first test trial is the one on the left. The correct answer for the second test trial is the one on the right. The correct answer for the third test trial, the one on the right. So why were you so divided? I'll tell you now, I seduced you, those of you who picked the one on the left. I made you do it. How did I do it? Look at these test trials. What's different about the faces is the internal features are completely different. The hair is the same, but the internal features are completely different. And so they do differ because of those internal features. What happened in the interim is what made you right or wrong. So on the first test trial, I gave you the choice between the real guy and a completely novel guy, and you asked you to think to yourself and many of you probably silently picked the real guy. For the second test trial, I didn't test you at all in the middle. But for the third face, I showed you an altered version of the real guy. The internal features are totally different, and even though the hair is the same, I paired it with a completely novel face. I seduced you into some of you into picking the wrong guy, and later on, you stuck with the wrong guy, some of you, on the final test. And so in our work with these materials, we've shown that it is pretty easy to induce subjects to pick the wrong face, a similar face. When you do this, it impairs your later ability to identify the right face. And there are other things that we're learning about this actual phenomenon of what happens when you're seduced into picking the wrong guy when you're later exposed to the right one. Now, I had a chance to demonstrate this phenomenon this year on 60 Minutes on a program that aired in March for the first time and re-aired in July. And the occasion for 60 Minutes to be covering this study was really a secondary to their major interest in talking about an actual case of wrongful conviction. The actual case that's described in this book is a case involving a woman. She was a rape victim. Her name is Jennifer Thompson. She has since gotten married, so it's Thompson Canino. She accused a man named Ronald Cotton, an African-American, of being her rapist. He was convicted in North Carolina. She was absolutely confident. And ultimately, DNA, after he'd spent many, many, many years in prison, DNA showed he was actually innocent. What makes this case a little different from the many others like it, where DNA has exonerated innocent people, is that these two people, I mean, you can imagine these, you know, what she must have felt like when she's told, guess what, DNA shows you pick the wrong guy. These two people have now, she apologized to him, he forgave her, they've since become friends. They wrote this book together that was just published called Picking Cotton, a wonderful title, and they are now going around campaigning for reforms in this area. They're anti-death penalty because, he could have been executed or had it been a murder case. And so on. The other thing that's interesting to me about the Ronald Cotton case is there was a time after Jennifer had picked Ronald Cotton and was sure it was him, when she was exposed to the real guy, Bobby Poole, DNA showed it was really him. And when she saw him, and the defense at that point was trying to show that this was the real guy, she looked at him and she said, no, that's not him. Her memory had become Ronald Cotton. When I was interviewed by Leslie Stahl, who the anchor for this program, I ran her through this demonstration that I did with you. And when I presented the two faces, the altered one that I'd seduced her to pick earlier, and the real face, which she looked at the same time, she just looked at these two faces for the longest time. She finally just said, I'm baffled, and then went ahead and picked the wrong face. So I just wanted to tell you that. So for all of you here who picked the wrong face on the final test, you are in really good company with this very smart, sophisticated investigative journalist. You might think, well, you know, these faces are awfully artificial. It's not really a real stressful situation. Would the same kinds of things happen? I mean, we do have the example of Ronald Cotton and it happening there to Jennifer Thompson. But could you show that experimentally in a situation that used a little bit more realistic type of stimuli and used real people and maybe a real stressful event of the sort that you often get in real crime situations? And I've had a chance now to collaborate on some new work that we are just now sending out for publication that is really unusual new work, primarily because of the subjects who participate in this particular work. The opportunity grows from a collaboration with a psychiatrist named Charles Morgan. His friends call him Andy. And Andy has access to a group of individuals. You may know this, but we have soldiers in this country who are routinely going through something called survival school. This is a school that teaches them how to survive and what to expect if they are ever captured as prisoners of war. So what happens in survival school is these soldiers are going through this experience where they learn how to evade the enemy, they learn how to escape if they're hunted down, they learn how to resist if they're captured, imprisoned, or tortured. They do get captured, and they get put in this mock prisoner of war camp. They are hooded, they're strapped together, they're stripped of their identities. It's an extremely upsetting experience for them. They're put into these little third world cells where they have these toilets, third world toilets with no toilet paper, my worst nightmare. And eventually they learn also how to be extracted by helicopter, which is going to happen to them if the jungle is too dense for them to land, for people, rescuers to land in. Eventually it's all over and there's an absolute flood of emotions. That's just a brief synopsis. It's a very stressful experience for these soldiers who go through the experience. You can see cortisol levels, average cortisol levels, stress hormones, the red bars, which are very high, and even higher than some other activities that are known to be quite stressful for people, such as skydiving for the first time and other activities. I recently read a memoir, just happened to come across this memoir that was written by somebody named Pham, called A Sense of Duty, and he went through this SEER school, the survival school, and he describes it in this book. He says, I was slammed against the wall. It swayed as I leaned back. He slapped me with his open hand at least six times until stars appeared in my vision. I bit my gums and my mouth was quickly filling with blood. And he experienced the waterboard torture. He said he left the SEER school a few pounds lighter with a swollen mouth and an incredible fear of being captured by the enemy. So it is a pretty stressful experience, and I managed to talk Andy Morgan and his collaborators into doing a study where we put misinformation into the environment of these survival school soldiers. So here they are, they're real people, they're encountering other people and activities. If they're fed misinformation, will they succumb to it or not? So I'm just going to tell you about one little piece of this experiment. It's a lot more complicated. And you can see here that the survival school involves 4 days of trying to evade the enemy, 30 minutes of that extremely stressful interrogation, slammed against the wall, blood in the gums. Then there is some isolation. And for some of the subjects in this particular study, they get some misinformation after a 30-minute interrogation of a fairly stressful nature. Others of these soldiers get no information, and then both groups get their memories tested later on. So what is the misinformation? During that isolation phase, somebody comes in and says, look at this photo, this person who interrogated you. Did your interrogator give you anything to eat? Did your interrogator give you a blanket? Did your interrogator give you any opportunity to speak to any other people? The problem is that the person in this photo is not the interrogator. It's a foil. And that foil can look really different. So for some subjects, here's the actual perpetrator, and here's the person in the photograph, the misinformation. And now, later on during the memory test, what happened in this particular study is 9 individuals are shown. This is what's called a target absent array because the real perpetrator is not there, but the foil is. So the right answer when these soldiers are looking at this particular array is, I don't see him there. And yet, that's not what most of these soldiers did. Here's what they did. If they had not gotten any misinformation, half of them went ahead and made a false identification of somebody in the array. They rarely chose the key foil, whom they had never seen at all. Well, they'd never seen any of them, actually. But look what happens in the group that had the foil put in their face while they were answering questions after that stressful interrogation was over. 91% of them went ahead and picked someone, and virtually all of them, the vast majority, are picking the foil as the person who conducted that interrogation. So I think you see that we are able to get these kind of results in an experimental situation and to study this phenomenon in an experimental situation where you've got trained soldiers going through a naturally very stressful experience and making a lot of mistakes. And, you know, when I think about this work, I do have to say that I do believe in publishing work and getting ideas out there and informing people of the way the mind works. But I do have a nagging kind of feeling that once we publish this work, which we are now about to do, we are really kind of educating the enemy on how to subvert justice, how to commit bad acts, and then contaminate the memories of the people upon whom those bad acts are performed. And it's not very hard to do. Well, this leads me now to another line of work. We turned our attention to the problem that more closely fits with a situation like the Ramona case, where it wasn't just changing a detail here and there about an event that actually was experienced, but what probably happened in that case is she had wholly false memories planted in her mind by some process, and we believe it was the therapeutic process and other aspects of suggestion in her environment. But in order to get a handle on how it is that people can develop these very rich, whole memories, we needed a different kind of paradigm. We needed to figure out a way, how are we going to try to plant an entirely false memory in the minds of people? I mean, you can't really go around telling people or trying to convince people that Daddy forced them, you know, to have sex over years, including sex with the family dog. So you need an analog. You need to figure out, because you got the Human Subjects Review Committee that's going to be, you know, scrutinizing your proposed research. They're not going to let you do it. You don't want to harm subjects, even in the name of science. So what could we do here? We needed to be able to think of an idea that we could plant in the minds of people so we could study this process, something that would have been at least mildly traumatic if it actually had happened. And that's the genesis for our idea. Let's see if we can make people believe that when they were a kid, they were lost in a shopping mall in a particular place. They were lost for an extended time, frightened, crying, ultimately rescued by an elderly person and reunited with the family. And with my graduate student, Jackie Pickrell, we succeeded in getting about a quarter of our subjects, after three suggestive interviews, to buy into that false belief or memory. We did it by telling our subjects, we've talked to your mother or father or older brother. We found out some things that happened to you when you were a child, and we really had done that. And we presented some true memories that the parents told us about. And then this made-up scenario about being lost in the shopping mall and frightened, crying, and rescued that we worked up with the parents. So it was completely constructed to be a pseudo-story. But all were presented to the subjects as if they were true. And by the time we were done plying our subjects with this fairly strong suggestion, as I said, about a quarter of our subjects had fallen sway to the suggestion and came to remember all or part of the experience. But our work, you know, some psychotherapists got very threatened by this work. They started to see that we were going to be aiming our sights at them and possibly some of their practices. Their immediate response to the presentation and publication of this work was, look, getting lost is so common, at least show us you can plant a whole memory for, if you think it can be done, for something that would be more unusual or bizarre if it actually had happened. And so another investigator came along, Ira Hyman, who works in the same area, convinced his subjects that when they were a kid, they had an accident at a family wedding. They spilled punch all over the parents of the bride. They were playing by the punch bowl and they accidentally did this. This group succeeded in convincing about a quarter of their subjects that they had had this made-up experience about the accident at the family wedding. You know, sometimes Hyman, too, as I and others get involved in court cases, and somehow the idea of Ira Hyman being an expert witness in a sex abuse case is just like too ironic to me. But he really is a very good scientist. The best work, I think, or at least one of the most excellent pieces of work by a Canadian, Stephen Porter, convincing subjects using this technique they were a victim of an indoor accident or an outdoor accident or a vicious animal attack. Porter's getting really, really good at this because he used a similar form of suggestion but was getting better at it, so he convinced 26% of his sample to have a complete false memory and an additional 30% to have a partial false memory. You don't need this strong form of suggestion to get people to develop false beliefs and false memories. You don't need to go to them and say, we've talked to your parents and we found out these things that happened to you. It's a pretty strong form. There are all kinds of other ways, and some of these techniques are the kinds of things that have been going on in some psychotherapy sessions. So you can do it with guided imagination. You don't remember who molested you, but you've got bulimia, and everyone I've seen with that set of symptoms was molested as a child. Why don't you just imagine who might have done this to you? And the person starts to engage in a series of acts of attempted imagination that can lead people to false memories. Dream interpretation. Common in therapy, if you've ever done therapy or been in therapy, maybe you've talked about your dreams. And as long as you recognize that day residue gets into the dreams at night, so what you're worrying about in the day can find its way as dream material, you know, into your nighttime experiences, there's nothing wrong with talking about what you're dreaming about. The problem comes when these therapists start to take that dream material and interpret it as a sign that something in particular happened to you in the past. And I am not kidding when I tell you that I have seen cases where the patient dreamt about a snake and the therapist said that was a penis. She dreamt about a serpent. In another case, the therapist said that was a penis. But I had one case, a sex abuse case, in the state of Washington where I used to teach, where the patient dreamt about a cinnamon roll and the therapist said that was a penis. And I thought, you know, I don't get this, but this one, maybe like a snake, you know, okay, but the cinnamon roll. And so, well, this is why cross-examination is so great, because we could find out what was going on in the mind of the therapist. It turns out for the therapist, the connection for her was the goo on the cinnamon roll. I know you'll never look at cinnamon rolls in quite the same way after this, but hypnosis can lead people in they're in this suggestible state, especially if they're highly hypnotizable, to false beliefs and false memories. Exposure to other people's memories, kind of thing that happens in group therapy, for example, that can lead people to false memories. You know, group therapy is really just, you know, like memory poker. I'm going to match your memory and raise you one with my even more bizarre memory. And that's how you get the growth of these memories. Plying people with false information, I'll give you some examples about that, or showing them doctored photographs. I love the work on doctored photographs. The first of those studies was done by Marianne Gary, Kim Wade. Marianne was a former postdoc of mine. And what they did in this particular work kind of is to take an actual photograph. Here's the subject when the subject's now an adult, but that's the subject when he was about a kid, you know, 4 or 5 years old, whatever, with his father. And you take that childhood photograph and you plop it into a hot air balloon ride. And then you show this doctored photo to subjects along with real photos from the family album. And guess what? After this kind of suggestive intervention, about half the subjects in this study started to remember this experience of going up in a hot air balloon ride with their father when they were a kid. So it's just kind of a marriage of Photoshop and memory distortion work. And well, the work gets criticized, all this work. People say, you know, maybe they really did get bit by an animal, and maybe they really did get lost in the mall. Maybe they really did have an accident at a family wedding, and what your technique did is to extract a true memory rather than planting a false one. In fact, I got asked that question today by one of the Dickinson students when I was talking about some related work. But that has led us, I and other experimenters, to say, well, what we need to do then is to plant memories of things that would be implausible or impossible, to try to prove to people that this is leading to false memories. That's the genesis of some recent work headed by my graduate student, Sherry Berkowitz, in which we planted a false memory that when you were on a childhood trip to Disney, you had your ear disturbingly, persistently, uncomfortably licked by the Pluto character. We think that's rather implausible, but then, you know, somebody will come back and say, well, you know, every now and then you might get a pedophile working at, Disneyland. So really, I guess we need to have it be impossible. And that was the genesis of some work where we convinced subjects that they had met at Disney, when they were a child, Bugs Bunny. Now, they could not have met Bugs Bunny at Disney. I mean, Bugs is a Warner Brothers character, would not be at a Disney resort. I mean, when the LA Times editorialist was writing about this study after I had presented it at a scientific meeting, he wrote the Waskily Wabbit would be arrested if he tried to go to Disney. And yet, here's Bugs. We made this fake ad for Disney. There's Bugs by the castle. It's all about an ad for Disney. You can't read the text, but it talks about the highlight of your day was when you saw Bugs Bunny. He waved you over, shook his hand. It was a perfect end to a perfect day. Our subjects just have to evaluate the ad. How much do you like it? Do you like the colors? Do you like the size of the print and the font? Anything about the ad to evaluate. And later on, they tell us about a childhood trip to Disney and which characters they remember meeting. And lots of people will now tell us they remember meeting Bugs Bunny. Our newest work, and this was alluded to in the introduction, looks at the consequences of having a false memory. I think I'll try to go through this fairly quickly, but do these memories, once we plant them, these false memories, have repercussions for people? Do they have effects on later intentions or thoughts or even behaviors? And our first effort to look at this question involved this idea. We were trying to make people believe that they got sick as children eating particular foods. And with my collaborators, Bernstein, Laney, and Morris, we planted this belief in the minds of people. We did it using the false information or false feedback technique, and this is just one example of that. So what happens when people come into the lab in the first session is we get a whole bunch of data from them about their personalities and their thinking about foods and their life. Then a week later, they come back, and we tell them that we fed all their data into our really smart computer program that determined that certain things probably happened to them when they were a child. The profile looks very personalized, so here's one for Johnny Jones, who learns that our smart computer thinks is pretty sure that he felt sick after eating a hard-boiled egg. I've italicized this critical item for you, but of course it wasn't for the subjects. It's embedded in a list of things we think are true of many kids, like you dislike spinach. We get our subjects to dwell on the experiences and try to think about them, maybe even imagine how it might have happened, like that guided imagination that we are so critical of. And then the subjects have to tell us what they want to eat at this imaginary party. You can eat any of the following foods. There's a great big long list. How likely are you to want to eat this food? Give it a 1 if definitely no, and give it an 8 if definitely yes. And then embedded on this much longer list, here are the critical items: pickles and hard-boiled eggs. And so the results. Here's how much people want to eat the two foods at the party, they tell us, if they haven't been exposed to any feedback at all. They have a slight preference here for the hard-boiled eggs. It's a summer party, then the dill pickles. But this is no feedback at all. Here's how much they want to eat the foods if they were exposed to the manipulation, but they didn't buy into it. They didn't develop a false belief or memory. And here's how much they want to eat the foods if they were exposed to the manipulation and they fell for it. They don't want to eat these foods as much. And so, this is one of the great moments for a scientist. When the graduate students come in with the graphs and Excel spreadsheets and so on, and I looked at these data and I said, this is great. I mean, these false memories are having consequences for people. They're avoiding the food, or they're telling us they don't want to eat the food at this imaginary party. If this would work for a fattening food, think about it. We could be on the brink of a new dieting technique. And so after we had shown it was possible to plant this false memory of getting sick, and it did have consequences, we went and did it with a fattening food and succeeded with strawberry ice cream. The whole story is really a lot more complicated, but the strawberry ice cream part of the story involves the same design: getting information from people, lots of information, having them come back a week later where they get the profile from the really smart computer program. Mary Smith, for example, is told that the computer has determined that these things happened to her. You felt ill after eating strawberry ice cream. She and other subjects have to dwell on the experience and try to develop a memory if they can get one. And there are various ways we have of getting them to elaborate, and here's what happened. That's how much people want to eat strawberry ice cream if they didn't get any feedback at all. Here's how much they want to eat it if they were exposed to the manipulation and they didn't buy into it. And here's how much they want to eat it if they were exposed to that manipulation and they fell for it. They don't want to eat it as much. And so we were pretty thrilled with this result, and even more thrilled when the results went all around the world and people took such a big interest. And I'll just show you two examples. Time magazine published a whole page on the mental diet. This was kind of exciting for us. And fortunately, they did an interview and they did publish the caveats. There was a German idea here, but we don't know how long these effects are going to last. And I was glad they said that, because you would need to have an effect that lasted if you were going to take this out on the road and try to, use it in any kind of applied way. After that, the New York Times Magazine, and we were really proud of this, published the 78 most innovative scientific ideas of the year that year, and there was the false memory diet. That was an exciting moment, too. They, too, published the caveats, two of them now. We don't know how long the effects are going to last, and we also don't know whether our manipulation is going to be strong enough that it would enable people to withstand and resist an actual bowl of strawberry ice cream put right in front of them. Well, we didn't know then, but we do know now. Because now we've published the study headed by Elke Gerhards, our collaborator from the Netherlands, Dan Bernstein, my longtime collaborator in this work, Harold Merkelbach, who's also at Maastricht University. And The design is very similar. Get information from people, bring them back a week later, tell them they got sick eating egg salad and our really smart computer knows it, but now they have a chance to actually eat sandwiches, and you can count how many sandwiches, egg salad sandwiches, these people eat at that time, immediately after the manipulation, and then again when they come back to the lab for a seemingly unrelated experiment several months later. Here's how many egg salad sandwiches people eat on the average when they have not been exposed to any manipulation. Here's how many they eat when they were exposed to the manipulation, but they didn't develop a false belief or memory. And you can see here they're avoiding the eating sandwiches immediately afterwards, but they're back to eating them again 4 months later. And here's how many egg salad sandwiches these subjects ate immediately after the manipulation, and then again 4 months later. So it does affect actual eating behavior, and it lasts. And this result was so stunning to me that I must say that I was gratified to see that there was an independent bit of research looking at the same question. Can the effects last? Can they affect actual eating behavior? By another research group, Scaboria, Mazzoni, and colleagues. And they did a similar kind of study independently, but theirs was extremely elegant, in which they showed that a week later, after a manipulation, people were not eating as much peach yogurt. It was natural for us at this point to wonder, and in the introduction there was an allusion to this study, if we could get people to think they got sick eating fattening food and they avoid it, maybe we could get them to have a warm, fuzzy memory about a healthy food, and they would want to eat it more. And so we've just published our results with asparagus. That was asparagus, a love story. We convinced people that they loved asparagus the first time they tried it. After planting that false memory in them and having them elaborate upon it, they tell us what they want to eat at Le Restaurant when they're out to dinner for a special occasion dinner. And we did find we could create this false memory in the minds of subjects. Those who were seduced by our manipulation embraced this food more, told us they wanted to eat more asparagus. They were willing to pay more for a pound of asparagus. And it looks like that what we were able to show is that we're just making the sight of asparagus, the thought of it, seem more appealing, appetizing, and less disgusting. And so at this point, well, I'm not really a great fan of case studies. There is one that I do wish desperately I could do. I would like to get my hands on this subject, and maybe there's some people here at Dickinson who can help me do that. The person I'm interested in is our former president, George Bush Sr., because he is famous for having said in some circles, I do not like broccoli. And what he said in full was this: I do not like broccoli. I haven't liked it since I was a little kid and my mother made me eat it. I'm president of the United States. I'm not going to eat any more broccoli. I like his attitude. Well, we believe if we could just get our hands on the former president and ply him with our suggestive manipulations that we've developed, it would just be a matter of time before he was saying that broccoli was one of his very favorite vegetables. If I had more time, I'd tell you about true and false memories. I'd answer the question I always get asked, who is more susceptible to these kinds of manipulations, or are we all? But I don't. And so let me close by just saying that we do believe this work has important theoretical implications for the our understanding of the human mind and memory in particular. We think we're close to developing almost a recipe for how you develop a false memory, and the steps you have to go through to get people to have these false beliefs and false memories, or how it happens out there in the real world when people are either advertently or inadvertently trying to accomplish this. There are practical implications here. The newer studies for nutritional selection, maybe for making a dent in the obesity problem in our society, but certainly for legal cases and how to extract more accurate and complete information from witnesses and less inaccurate information that has led to some of the tragedies we've seen. And so I'll end with the Hillary story where I began. We've got two versions of what might be going on with her. Pinocchio suggests that she was deliberately lying. Her explanation, I made a mistake, I had a different memory, is much more in line with the kind of work that I and others are doing in this false memory area. And again, it shows you that you don't get immunity from these kinds of problems by just because you're intelligent, experienced, and educated. So thank you for listening and for this invitation. Thank you. Do I turn this over to you? Am I turning this back to you now?
You stay right here.
I stay right here.
Great. Okay. This goes.
Wow.
As well. The Dickinson College Award in memory of Joseph Priestley is this medallion. I hope you can get a little feel for it from up there in the audience. It was struck from the original mold of a medallion created by Josiah Wedgwood in 1779 that was based on a portrait of Joseph Priestley drawn 4 years earlier in 1775 by John Flaxman. And as I said earlier, the award was first presented by Dickinson College in 1952 and has been presented each year since to a distinguished scientist honored for discoveries that contribute to the welfare of humankind. Elizabeth Loftus, I am most pleased to present to you the Dickinson College Award in memory of Joseph Priestley in recognition of your extraordinary achievements.
Oh, my God. Well, thank you. That's just fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us this evening.